Hi, I'm Mac Dimon, a partner in S&C's M&A group, and I'm joined by two of my colleagues. John Hardiman, a partner in the firm's litigation group with over 35 years of experience in handling high-stakes M&A litigation, and Brian Frawley, who is also a partner and the co-coordinator of the firm's M&A litigation practice. This podcast offers an overview and analysis of recent Delaware developments. Specifically, we will explore the MSW Safe Harbor, Caremark claims, the 220 landscape, and COVID-19-related M&A litigation. I'm going to turn it over to Brian to start us off on the substance.
Thanks, Matt. As a refresher, transactions in which a controlling stockholder or where the controlling stockholder gets a unique benefit are generally subject to entire fairness review, Delaware's highest level of judicial scrutiny. But under the MFW line of cases, the defendants can avail themselves to the much more desirable business judgment rule if at the outset the conflicted transaction is conditioned on both the approval of an independent special committee with the power to negotiate and to say no, and doing so in accordance with their fiduciary duties of care and loyalty, and as well as the approval of an informed and uncoerced majority of minority of stockholders. A few recent cases demonstrate the heavy burden on directors to meet this MFW line at the motion to dismiss stage. As will be a recurring theme today, the ability to plead sufficient bad facts to get around any MFW defense often is benefited greatly by access to pre-suit books and records, which was the case in all of the matters we're going to discuss. The first, in February, in AmTrust Financial Services litigation, Chancellor Bouchard denied a motion to dismiss, finding that the complaint adequately alleged that the sale process and a take private by a 55% stockholder did not comport with MFW. Because the special committee members in that case were also defendants in a pending shareholder derivative litigation where the court observed they faced potential personal liability under what the court described as, quote, troubling facts, the court ruled that the committee members lacked independence in this merger transaction, which would have benefited them in the related derivative suit. Last month, in Dell Technologies Class 5 stockholders litigation, Vice Chancellor Laster denied a motion to dismiss in a post-closing challenge to Dell's attempt to consolidate its ownership in VMware, which had a publicly traded Class V tracker stock. The factual background is a little complicated, but for our purposes, it's sufficient to point out that Dell decided to retire the Class V stock through either a negotiated redemption of the Class V Dell shares or exercising a charter right to force conversion of the Class V shares into a different class of Dell shares. Because of this conversion right, the Class V shares traded at a substantial discount. In an effort to invoke MFW, Dell formed a special committee to negotiate a redemption of the Class V shares, but it did not empower the special committee to refuse to exercise Dell's forced conversion right. After stockholders objected to the price the special committee negotiated, the company then began negotiating directly with stockholders and ultimately arrived at a higher deal price that the committee ratified in a short late-night meeting. At the motion to dismiss stage, Vice Chancellor Laster held that both the special committee process and the majority-minority vote were flawed. First, the court found that by retaining the right for the company to bypass the committee and the stockholder vote by implementing the forced conversion right, the process was not MFW compliant because the committee and the shareholders both did not have the ability to say no. The court could have stopped there and just denied the motion, but it didn't. The court went on to hold that the special committee abdicated its duty of care by, quote, abandoning the field and leaving stockholders to negotiate the transaction directly with the company. The court also went on to find that the special committee acted disloyally by retaining a lead banker with historic ties to the controllers, and that neither of the two committee members was sufficiently independent of the controlling stockholders. The court also found that even though the forced conversion right appears in the charter, both the committee process and the majority of the minority vote were coerced because of public threats to exercise the forced conversion absent the negotiated redemption and the prospect that the negotiated redemption was the only way to get out of what the court described as the unappealing status quo associated with the discount the Class V stock exhibited. The court also found various disclosure issues suggesting that the stockholder vote was not informed. Although the court's decision emphasized repeatedly Delaware's traditionally generous pleading standard, certain aspects of the opinion could signal greater scrutiny of MFW deal processes and the related Corwin ratification doctrine. More likely, however, as in Dell and the other cases we're discussing today, there clearly was a common theme that bad facts found in books and records discovery made for bad outcomes on motions to dismiss. Matt, John, any further observations?
From a transactional lawyer's perspective, it can be very difficult to keep an eye on all the deal participants and ensure the special committee is truly in charge. But it is essential and something that needs to be established right from the start. Otherwise, it is going to be very hard to convince the Delaware judges to apply the business judgment rule. The other thing I would point out is that MFW does not mean you throw practicality out the window. There are ways to satisfy the MFW conditions and involve, say, the management team rolling over in a take private in the negotiations if they can be helpful, which they often can be. But that involvement needs to be directed and supervised by the special committee.
One other thing worth mentioning, Matt and Brian, is that if you're going to commit to the MFW process, it's important to do so early. In a recent case, In Re HomeFed Corporation, Chancellor Bouchard denied a motion to dismiss because the controller negotiated its offer price with two substantial stockholders before presenting the proposal to the board. The court cautioned that defendants are only entitled to dismissal if the controller self-disables before the start of substantive economic negotiations. Well, I guess that's enough on that topic. Let's talk about the Caremark doctrine. Now, not to get too academic, but derivative actions are brought by shareholders on behalf of the corporation. I'm sure you all remember that. The injury being vindicated is to the corporation, not the shareholder individually. But shareholders don't just get to usurp the corporation's right to pursue its claims without just cause. They either have to make a demand on the corporation's board to bring the claim that the board refuses, or they need to be able to demonstrate that demand would be futile because the board was too conflicted to make an objective decision on whether to bring the claim. That's where Caremark comes in. One way to show conflict is that the claim is against the board members themselves, not for merely approving something like a transaction proposed by management, but rather because the board did something wrong itself. You may ask, like what? Well, not sufficiently supervising management is the answer supplied by Caremark. Delaware courts have traditionally been very hard on Caremark claims, so much so that the phrase, a Caremark claim is the hardest to plead, has become a standard refrain in the case law. Almost any plan of supervision, for instance, an audit committee in the financial area, seemed to defeat a Caremark claim. That, plus the fact that any allegation of demand futility must be pretty specific, and then imposition of potential personal liability on directors requires a showing of bad faith under Delaware Section 102B7, has meant that not many boards have lost too much sleep over Caremark claims over the years. Perhaps that should change. In a case last year named Marchand, the Delaware Supreme Court reversed a dismissal of a Caremark claim, which was the first time that happened for a while. The alleged facts of the case were pretty bad, involving public safety and the sale of unhealthy ice cream, of all things. Nevertheless, those of us who practice in the area had our collective antennae go up as a result of the ruling. This year, in the Hughes case in Delaware Chancery, Vice Chancellor Laster denied another Caremark motion to dismiss. Again, there were pretty bad facts. While the company at issue was incorporated in Delaware, it was based in China. In 2014, it had publicly announced that its internal controls were deficient and announced a program to correct them. In 2017, despite the supposed improvements, a restatement was necessary and the company announced again that its internal controls needed to be remedied. The final nail in the coffin were minutes of board and audit committee meetings obtained by the plaintiff through a 220 demand that showed that the board's adherence to its new procedures was quite lax, with meetings occurring sporadically and lasting as few as 30 minutes. Take heart, there have been two recent Caremark dismissals, both by Vice Chancellor Slights in Delaware Chancery, and both, somewhat amusingly, by plaintiffs who claim they were not bringing Caremark claims, even though the claims walked and talked like Caremark claims, perhaps because they had the refrain of a Caremark claim is the most difficult to plead ringing in their ears. The cases, Shibui and GoPro, were both analyzed under Caremark, notwithstanding the plaintiff's contention they didn't intend to bring a Caremark claim, but both were very weak. And the Caremark claims were very weak, and therefore both were dismissed. I think the takeaway is that you can't ever forget that the board is a supervisory body, so it's probably not too unreasonable for the courts to ask it to supervise. But most boards have the proper processes in place, regular meetings, various committees responsible for various supervisory functions. But 220 demands, which courts are permitting to be broader and broader, will out a board that does not adhere to its processes or only pays lip service to them. On the other hand, 220 demands will also vindicate boards that do exercise appropriate supervision. It's important to remember we are still far from the point where courts will second guess the supervisory decisions of boards. I don't know if Matt O'Brien has anything to add.
This last takeaway is significant and consistent with Delaware's focus on record-keeping practices at the board and committee levels. Boards and committees should always document their deliberations in formal minutes as soon as possible after a meeting and with a level of detail that will withstand later scrutiny.
This is probably a good segue to our third topic, the current state of 220 demands in Delaware. The Delaware courts had long urged putative plaintiffs to make use of 220 before bringing what were perceived to be ill-thought-out or ill-supported litigation. Section 220, which permits stockholders of Delaware companies to inspect corporate books and records that are necessary and essential to a proper purpose, now precede the vast majority of derivative litigation and deal litigation in Delaware courts, and they are virtually ubiquitous following public company mergers. Stockholders have the burden to assert that their purpose is proper, and to the extent that they wish to investigate wrongdoing, a, quote, credible basis to suspect wrongdoing has occurred. This is a light burden that may amount to no burden at all in the wake of some recent cases, including the AmerisourceBergen decision earlier this year. In that case, plaintiffs sought documents to investigate possible wrongdoing and to, quote, evaluate possible litigation or other corrective measures, end quote, in connection with AmerisourceBergen's distribution of opioids. The company argued that purpose was not proper because the plaintiffs hadn't established a credible basis to suspect actionable wrongdoing as opposed to run-of-the-mill mismanagement. The court found that a credible basis existed to suspect unspecified mismanagement, and that it didn't matter whether the mismanagement was potentially actionable under Delaware legal standards. This holding would mean that virtually any corporate trauma would qualify as a credible basis to investigate wrongdoing by alleging some vague purpose for the request other than litigation. In a subsequent decision in Woods versus Sahara, the same vice chancellor cited AmerisourceBergen for the proposition that plaintiffs need not assert an end to which the inspection information will be put. Despite AmerisourceBergen, which is the subject of an appeal, there are limits to what a court of chancery will accept as a proper purpose. Vice Chancellor Slights recently rejected a stockholder's attempt to obtain documents to wage a proxy contest, absent a stronger showing of wrongdoing. Although the Vice Chancellor did signal that under certain different circumstances, the court might allow a stockholder to receive books and records regarding board-level conduct for use in a proxy contest, and there was at least one such Delaware decision many years ago, that was not the proper case for such books and records. John, any thoughts?
Well, listen, 220 demands are a pain in the neck because it's like discovery without litigation, but they can be quite helpful in a motion to dismiss. As a practice pointer, if a corporation is going to comply with a 220 demand, get an agreement from the plaintiffs that the material produced can be referred to at the motion to dismiss stage. Because if a company is doing things right and has good minutes and shows that it exercises due care over issues, having those minutes to use and a motion to dismiss can be quite a good weapon. That being said, our last topic of the day, and one which is of high interest considering what's going on in the world these days, are people trying to get out of deals because of COVID-related issues. And Matt's going to give us a little background on some of those matters.
Exactly. We want to touch on some of these COVID-19 related M&A litigations that have been going on. Since the early stages of the COVID pandemic through present, parties to pending M&A deals have been considering and continue to consider their contractual rights, obligations, and options. Many of those parties have moved forward with their planned transactions on their original terms, and we expect that to continue for many deals. Some have walked away amicably, but in other cases, buyers have sought to terminate executed agreements on the basis that COVID-19 has had a material adverse effect on the target company's business. While we await substantive feedback from the Delaware courts on this issue, a few observations. One, seller beware. Be careful who you end up suing in these litigations. In Realogy, the server worldwide, the seller brought suit to enforce a private equity buyer's obligation to close over the buyer's invocation of an M&A provision. The vice chancellor in the case dismissed seller's claim for specific performance because the seller unwittingly also sued the buyer's affiliate who was writing the equity check, which, as it turns out, was expressly barred by the equity commitment letter, and as a result, automatically terminated the equity financing for the transaction. Because financing was an express condition to specific performance, the seller basically had no ability to force the buyer to close, thus ending the litigation effectively on that issue. The seller suit rendered the MA issues moot. The type of equity commitment provision at issue in Realogy is not uncommon for private equity acquisitions and was likely a key factor in L Brands allowing Sycamore to walk away from their deal. Also, it's important to think about drafting history in advance. A number of the MAE disputes will involve intense scrutiny of the applicable MAE provision, including the drafting history. I've always had the view that less can often be more in drafting MAE provisions, and that starting with a very aggressive or kitchen sink approach usually leads to a tortured end result and a bad drafting history, which in a dispute makes the judge's job of interpreting the clear meaning of the provision at issue extremely difficult. Brian, John, do you guys have any thoughts from a litigation perspective on these issues?
Sure, it's Brian. So, you know, after several decades with just a handful of cases providing any guidance on MAE issues, we now have well over a dozen cases pending, not just in Delaware, but in other states that may provide some useful guidance on how these provisions will be interpreted in practice. To what extent these cases get to a judgment remains to be seen, so keep on the lookout. John?
Yeah, all I'd add is I'm anxious to see one of the cases get the judgment because I'm curious as to what the bias of the courts will be in this crazy COVID world we live in now. Will they have sympathy for the party that's bought a company that's suddenly COVID damaged, or will they say, come on, everybody's got problems, everybody needs to tough it out until this problem's resolved? We'll see. But in the meantime, thanks to everybody for listening. If you want more information about our practice, please visit us at the web at www.solcrom.com. Have a good day.